How do you introduce Peter Rosen? Peter Rosen is one of the giants of our specialty. In Brian Sink's new book, Anyone, Anything, Anytime, which I strongly recommend you get as a Christmas present, this is essentially a biography of Peter Rosen, because he is the specialty from the beginning. You first run into Peter in this book in a section called, quote, The Street Fighter from Brooklyn. Peter never completed high school. He enrolled at the University of Chicago in 1951, after which he attended Washington University Medical School in St. Louis from 1956 to 1960. He then said he was seduced into general surgery. He did his residency at Highland Hospital in Oakland, California, at a time when the surgeons ran the emergency department. He entered the military in 1965, served in the Army Medical Corps for a few years, and then he spent 3 years in Thermopolis, Wyoming, as a surgeon, where he took ER call every fifth night. And he even assisted the local veterinarian with dog surgery. Soon after establishing a coronary care unit, the first coronary care unit in that part of the country, right? He became a patient in it. He had a heart attack when he was 34 years old. Decided that life as a surgeon was too stressful, so he took a job back at the University of Chicago in the emergency department. There he became an evangelist for this newly emerging specialty. One of his first residents was Harvey Meislin. Harvey Meislin is now president of the American Board of Medical Specialties. After tiring of the political infighting in Chicago, he took a job at Denver General Hospital, brought out one of his recent graduates, Vince Markovchik, Temple class of 1970, I might mention, with him. Vince Markovchik and Rick Yucata were in the same medical school class at Temple, believe it or not. In 1979, Dr. Rosen wrote an essay that eventually defined our specialty, the biology of emergency medicine. In 1980, he edited the first edition of what has become the primary textbook in our specialty, Emergency Medicine Concepts and Clinical Practice, or as it is now known, Rosen's. That's what we call it. Not satisfied with several major textbooks, he started the Journal of Emergency Medicine, which he still serves as editor-in-chief. Dr. Rosen joined the American Academy of Emergency Medicine very early in its existence, and he's been one of our most stalwart proponents. He moderates the Resident and Student Research Forum at our annual scientific assembly, and the highest honor that we as an organization can give one of our members in AAEM is the Peter Rosen Award. We have our own award today. We have Peter here in person. I'm proud to call him my friend. I'm delighted to introduce him, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Peter Rosen.
Thank you, Joe. That's very flattering. I have to tell you a story about dog surgery in Thermopolis. You know that there's a legend that dogs tend to resemble their owners. Well, when I was in Thermop, one of my best friends was the large animal vet in town, and I had actually done more dog surgery than he had because I did some research on dogs, and it involved some surgery. So when he had animals to operate on, I used to go and help him. Well, I operated with him on three dogs that had duodenal ulcers, and I operated on the masters of all three dogs for duodenal ulcer. So the resemblance between dog and owner is sometimes physiologic as well as emotional. I have recently been involved in a project in Italy. Harvard has a contract with the region of Tuscany to help them develop the field of emergency medicine as a specialty. And in watching that development, it is a good reminder of how emergency medicine developed in the United States. And I also would advise you to take a look at Brian Zink's book, Maybe a lot of it will be boring to those of you who don't know the people that were described by Brian, but as somebody who lived through it, it was tremendously accurate in terms of reminding me of some of the problems we had, some of the difficulties in beginning the specialty, and the recognition that, in fact, there are not an infinite number of solutions to the problem of how to deliver emergency care. And I've often said that I don't understand why emergency medicine is the youngest specialty. It seems to me it should have been the first specialty, but it wasn't. There obviously has been an evolution of medicine as a whole in the United States, and there's a book by Robert Starr on the economic development of medicine that actually serves as a very good history of medicine in the United States. At the time of the revolution, most of medical care was delivered at home. It was not delivered in a hospital. Hospitals were where you went to die. The famous Mass General Hospital is located where it is on the Charles River, because that's where they used to slide the bodies. Ambulance services began to be significant in this country after World War II, but not really until after Korea. But curiously enough, ambulance service developed in this country fairly extensively up until the time of World War II. And as a development of care, the Civil War was a tremendous impetus to the development of an ambulance service. But ambulance service was basically killed by World War II because of personnel. All of the ambulance drivers were drafted and went off to fight the war. And ambulance service died in the country because the cost of running an ambulance became too high. So that in itself is an interesting history. My father was an intern at Bellevue Hospital in 1922, and the medical care on an ambulance used to be the intern. And they used to ride in the back of the ambulance, and he said every year they lost an intern who'd fall asleep and fall off the back of the ambulance. The other interesting change in the United States, which in part was driven by economics, as Starr described so eloquently, is the economic changes. And World War II produced another difference, and that was the onset of specialization in the United States. Prior to World War II, there were only a couple of medical specialties. The first specialty board was actually ophthalmology sometime in the 30s, and the second was general surgery. And virtually all the other specialty boards were created post-World War II. My father was a GP surgeon. He had actually done some formal training in surgery, although not a complete residency. And his practice consisted of what a GP's practice did in those days. He delivered babies, he did surgery, he had an x-ray machine in his office, read his own films. And post-World War II, he was offered his boards in about five different specialties: pediatrics, radiology, internal medicine, general surgery, and OBGYN. And all he had to do was agree to confine his practice to one of those fields. And in one of the stupider political decisions that he made in his lifetime, he said, "Why do I want to be a specialist? I do all those things, and I don't need to do that." Well, he was wrong. He did need to do that, and he needed to do it for economic as well as political reasons. When I joined my practice in Thermopolis, Wyoming, as a general surgeon, my partner was a GP surgeon. He had not formally trained in surgery, but he was doing a lot of surgery. And in fact, at the time I finished my residency in surgery in 1965, over half the operations in the United States were performed by untrained surgeons. Pediatricians did their own tonsillectomies, did their own circumcisions. General surgeons were in competition with general practitioners who actually did unbelievably major operations, including gastric resection. But I could get paid twice as much as my partner for the same operation because I was a board-certified surgeon. So my father's decision not to specialize cost him both economically and politically, because many of the hospitals threw off of their medical staffs anybody who wasn't specialized. And that, in fact, did happen to my father. Pre-hospital care did not exist in the United States for many years, post-World War II. Ambulances were run for the most part by morticians. Some said there was a conflict of interest there, but I said that it was just double dipping. You got to take the patient to the hospital and then from the hospital. But in fact, the care of patients in the field had declined until coronary care raised its head. Now, during the time that I was a surgical resident, ICUs were created. That was in the early 60s. And prior to that, when a patient was deemed particularly ill, they had special duty nurses. And I remember as cardiac surgery evolved in the country, one of the nursing supervisors was talking to the cardiac surgeon when I was an intern at the University of Chicago and asked him if he wanted special duty nurses for his post-op patient. And he said, oh no, he's way too sick for that. And the special duty nurses for cardiac patients were actually the surgical residents. The special duty nurses were not specially trained nurses. They were, for the most part, nurses who were partially retired. Well, Dr. Pantridge was an Irish cardiologist, and he got the idea that if you could stabilize patients in the field, then you could save some lives. And so he assigned some of his cardiac fellows to an ambulance in Belfast, Ireland, and demonstrated that, in fact, they did have many patients who were able to salvage. In retrospect, there seems to have been a greater benefit for the patients with inferior wall MIs than with anterior. But nevertheless, it was a model that was of great interest around the world, and the second mobile coronary care unit was in Manhattan at St. Vincent's Hospital, headed by a cardiologist named William Grace. And I had the privilege of hearing both Dr. Grace and Dr. Pantridge discuss their units at a meeting that I went to in Salt Lake City in the late 60s. And the major difference between their two units was that Dr. Grace hadn't figured out how to make sure that his ambulance was only called for cardiac patients. He said that 50% of their runs turned out to be something else. And, of course, that was the burning question of emergency medicine. How do you know what's an emergency? And I'm not sure we've agreed on a definition to this day. I heard them lecture because I wanted to start an intensive unit for my surgical patients in Wyoming. I worked in a town of 3,500 people, but I covered three towns that were each 30 miles apart. And I wanted a post-op care for my patients, because once the ICU was developed, it became impossible to get any nursing care for a sick patient on the floor. Think of it today. What kind of patients can you care for outside of a unit? And for the most part, they're patients who don't need to be in the hospital. Well, that was true in those days, and when we opened the ICU at Highland Hospital, where I did my surgical residency, we lowered operative mortality rate by 30%. So post-op care is really quite important, and when I got to Wyoming, there was no ICU. The feds were coming up with some dollars to create CCUs, and I went off to take a course in coronary care management in Salt Lake City so that I could develop a CCU ICU for my surgical patients. And I was nominated by the other doctors on the hospital staff, because they didn't want to go take the course, to be the first director of the coronary care unit in Thermopolis, Wyoming. And it was actually one of the better courses I've ever taken in medicine. They designed it on the basis of what do you need to know to take care of a heart attack, as opposed to what would it be nice for you to know. So it was a very pragmatic, very focused course. And in fact, the first paper I ever wrote in medicine was on cardioversion of a post-op patient. Cardioversion was basically invented in the late 60s. And prior to that, any conversion of a dysrhythmia was being done chemically, mostly by slowing the rapid heart rate with digitalis. And my first paper was on a patient who had had a hysterectomy by one of my partners, and who had developed an infection post-op and dehissed her wound, and she was lying in bed with her bowels hanging out of her belly because they couldn't get her abdomen closed, and she developed an SVT. So after spending about 2 days trying to convert her with quinidine and digoxin, she was beginning to fail in the sense that she was losing her blood pressure and she was really not doing well. So not knowing how dangerous it was to cardiovert somebody on digitalis, I said, what the hell, and shocked her and converted her to a sinus rhythm rather than to asystole, as is promised when you cardiovert someone on dig. And I have to say it was one of the more dramatic moments of my medical life, because she did develop asystole for a few beats after I gave her the shock, and I think I developed the tachycardia. But she not only, it was very curious, and I've always wanted to do some research on it afterwards, she not only stopped her dysrhythmia, but within 48 hours she healed her wound. Now, we do know that electric current in wounds has a potential assist in healing broken bones, but I've never seen anything about it in terms of soft tissue healing. So maybe we ought to be cardioverting all of our lacerations. Anyway, it's an interesting observation, and I became the director of that CCU, ICU, and in the first year of operation, we lowered the hospital mortality for acute MI from 46% to 2%, and during that year, we salvaged two patients under the age of 40 who had an episode of fibrillation that was recognized and defibrillated, who would have died the year before because there was one nurse who covered the entire hospital and the emergency department. The night I got admitted to my own coronary care unit, we had a protocol that every patient had to have a central line, and we put in peripheral centrals. The nurse refused to stick me. She said, oh, I can't do that. I said, of course you can. And you know you want to, but she but she wouldn't do it, so I had to insert my own central line. Anyway, I survived my own coronary care unit, and that was how I fell into emergency medicine. So in 1971, I went to start emergency medicine at the University of Chicago. They had decided to hire a full-time director of emergency medicine because they didn't really know what to do with the emergency department. When I interned there in 1960, the department saw about 5,000 visits a year. And when I returned in 1971, the department was seeing about 52,000 visits a year. It was stressful. The workload in 1960 was managed by one intern and a good nurse. And I say a good nurse because she knew a hell of a lot more than I did. I have to candidly admit that I knew absolutely nothing when I graduated medical school. It was probably the worst 4 years of education I've ever endured. And I did not know anything about anything related to medicine. Virtually all the clinical medicine that I know I learned in residency and subsequently, and the only thing I learned in medical school was how to do an LE prep, and I don't even know what LE is anymore. I had some real triumphs as an intern in the emergency department. I put on my first cast. It was an 82-year-old lady who broke her foot trying to change a light bulb and falling off her stepladder. And I'd seen casts made before, so much for see one, do one, teach one. So I was doing it, having seen it. And I kept adding plaster to try to get it to look pretty and smooth the way the orthopods could do. And I finally created a cast that was so heavy that the woman had to be carried to her automobile. And when she came back to get her cast off, the orthopedic resident called me and said, "You come down here and saw this off." It must have weighed 40 pounds. Then another patient who came in complaining of a sore throat. And I looked in there and I saw a gray, shaggy membrane. And I said, "I read about that. That's diphtheria. This woman needs a tracheotomy." But I didn't know how to do a trach, fortunately. And I called the surgical resident, who took a little better history than I did, and found out that the woman had been treating herself with a home remedy recommended by her aunt, which was to gargle with melted butter. So much for the gray, shaggy membrane. So she didn't get the trach that I thought she needed. Well, when I returned in 1971, the manpower had increased mightily. There was now a first-year resident in medicine and a first-year resident in surgery and two interns and the same good nurse. 52,000 visits. And every day I would be visited by an administrator who said to me, "You have to turn these patients away, the ones who can't pay." And I said, "Yes, and how am I to do that?" And he'd say, "Well, you just decide which ones don't need to be treated and turn them away." And I said, "Well, I found out last night how to turn the patients away, and I am going to need your help to implement it." And he said, "Well, how is that?" And I said, "Well, last night at change of shift, somebody fired a gun in the waiting room and the place emptied out. And what I want your help with is a cannon that I can fire at every change of shift." But he wouldn't buy me a cannon. The care of patients was absolutely frightening. And I don't know why it took us so long to figure this out in the United States, but that emergency medicine is a recognizable field. There is a body of knowledge that has to be acquired. There are technical tests that have to be mastered. And all of these can be taught, but they don't come to you by revelation. They have to be read, they have to be seen, they have to be experienced. And why we thought that house officers were capable of managing these problems with no supervision and with no prior knowledge is just beyond me. And what made it possible to develop the specialty at the University of Chicago was a bad event. Now, you all know that to have good experience, you have to have had a series of bad experiences. Well, we had a very bad experience. We killed a graduate student. And the way we killed him was through ignorance. This young man came in with a perforated ulcer. And the first year resident in medicine was caring for him, had never seen a patient with a perforated ulcer and didn't recognize the problem. And in retrospect, it wasn't all that straightforward. He asked for help from the first year surgeon, who advised a few tests, and then when they were negative, they sent the patient home and he died of peritonitis. It wasn't recognized by the first-year radiology resident who read his films as negative because he didn't have easily recognizable free air. So the institutional response to this was to fire all three of the first-year residents. And I, of course, thought that that was unreasonable and went to bat for them and managed to turn that decision around. I said, if we don't provide supervision, then how can we blame them for not knowing what we know? And where were all the people who knew how to recognize perforated ulcers? They were home in bed. And they will never be seen in this hospital after afternoon tea. So how can we punish residents for not knowing what they don't know? And how can we produce a manpower that will, in fact, be effective? I had been at the university about a month when we had a faculty meeting, the subject of which was the emergency department. And in the 6 years that I was at the University of Chicago, it was the only faculty meeting that had 100% attendance. And I remember my chairman of surgery, at the time I had been appointed in surgery, standing up and saying, anybody who would do full-time emergency medicine is demeaning to this faculty. Welcome to the university, Dr. Rosen, since I was there to do full-time emergency medicine. And the chairman of endocrinology suggested that all we needed was $3,000 worth of bricks. If we just closed the emergency department, we wouldn't have any patients to worry about. That was sort of the level of thought at one of the major universities in the country. And I suggested that they had a number of alternatives. The reason I was there was that I had interned there, and when I applied for the position, I didn't know that there was a position open. What had happened was I wrote a letter to my surgical mentor, the guy who let me do that appendectomy the first morning of my internship that seduced me into surgery, and he had just died of a heart attack. And his mail was being answered by a transplant surgeon who was in charge of the emergency department but certainly didn't want to be. And they decided to create a position of director of emergency medicine. And I guess I was chosen from a long list of other candidates, namely nobody. And I was acceptable because I'd interned there. And the real reason I got the job was that the chairman of the search committee was a hematologist who had been a medical student when I was an intern, and I had taught him how to do a cut-down. And so he told the group that I needed to be hired because I was a fantastic teacher. So it shows you that generosity is rewarded sometimes in the future, or perhaps punished since I became the director. When I went to take the job, I had no idea what academic hierarchies were, and I had heard about tenure, and it seemed to me that that would be a good thing to have. So I said, I won't come unless you give me tenure. And I had absolutely no justification for being appointed with tenure in terms of academic productivity. I mean, one paper on cardioversion of a post-op patient hardly signifies a publication record. But they were in trouble, and that's the best time to get a job. So they, in fact, gave me tenure, and it's the only job in which I've had tenure since. And boy, did I need it. If I hadn't had tenure, they would have fired me after the first month. So I actually did everything backwards. I started in medicine, in clinical medicine. Outside of the university, I became an academic physician at the top, and I would certainly recommend that. It's much nicer to start as an associate professor than as a lecturer. And I started with tenure and then over time lost my tenure. So it's a better way to do it. But when I got to the University of Chicago, there was nobody to work in the emergency department. And the source of the residency in emergency medicine was the fact that the surgical residents who had to cover the ER revolted. They had too few to cover the department for a whole year. So what would happen is when someone got sick or they ran out of residents, they would pull back a resident from another service who was in his second year. And there were some surgical residents that had probably spent a total of 3 years in the emergency department as part of their surgical residency, none of whom, I might add, ever went to do emergency medicine. Anyway, they said, we didn't come here to be emergency physicians, and we're not going to go back. So there was nobody to cover the surgical emergencies. And I went to the president of the university, who was Ed Levy, and he granted me special money to moonlight the surgical faculty to cover the emergency department, which was very instructive. At the time, we were paying them $25 an hour, which doesn't seem like much, but it was quite a lot of money in those days, especially when you were on a fixed annual salary, and this basically was increased dollars. So that was one thing that was interesting. The other thing that was interesting was how badly the professors of surgery performed in the emergency department. They were scared to death of seeing patients without having a resident to assign the project to. And they also had strange ethics about covering their shift. I'd get a phone call 5 minutes before the shift and someone saying, "I can't come tonight, I have a dinner party." And then when they got there, they would hide in the doctor's workroom because they really didn't like seeing patients. So within 1 year, I had approval to start a residency in emergency medicine. And if we hadn't had the professors of surgery down there, we probably never would have gotten that approval. It didn't make them more friendly after we started the residency, but at least it opened the door for the residency. And I was able to recruit a resident and start the first resident in 1972, a year after I came to the university, and the first full class started in 1973. Harvey Meislin was in that class. It was, in fact, one of the best resident groups I have ever assembled anywhere, and everybody brags about how well they do on their match and how low they go on their match list. Well, that year, to fill 8 spots, I went to 10 places. Guess how many candidates we had? Right. So the wellness of your match really is kind of artificial. But that was a great class. Those guys were the pioneers. They were the ones who were willing to start something new. There was no recognition of emergency medicine. I went to start a residency, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice to get listed in the Green Book of postgraduate training sites? So I wrote a letter to the AMA, how do I get my new training program in emergency medicine listed in the Green Book? And they never answered the letter. They just didn't know what to do with emergency medicine, and they wanted it to go away, and therefore they said, well, we won't do anything. In a way, that was a blessing. The curriculum hadn't been invented. I didn't know the difference then between a goal and an objective. I don't now. But I didn't have to worry about it. All I had to do was figure out how to get residents and how to start a training program. We got residents by putting an ad in the New England Journal. And I had some of the most wonderful people I've ever worked with. Of that group of 8 residents, only one of them is now not doing emergency medicine, and he worked as a departmental chairman for a while and then went and did anesthesia. And one is still at the private hospital in Chicago that he went to after graduation, and the rest have all become professors and chairmen of departments of emergency medicine. Harvey Meislin was one, George Sternbach was one. Mike Tomlanovich, who started the program at Henry Ford in Detroit. It was a wonderful group. But they were the pioneers. And you've got to recognize that pioneers don't hang around forever. And they're followed by the settlers. And the settlers come in and they open the churches and they close the whorehouses and they just have rules and regulations and bureaucracies, and it's a different mind frame. And the pioneers are fun, but they're not very good at staying in any one place. They like to move around and they like to do new things. And I think that the field certainly required that, but it does also require the settlers. Well, Bruce Janiak was a pioneer. I don't know how many of you know Bruce, but he basically was the first resident in the country, and he designed his own residency. He went to the chairman of medicine and said, "I like the emergency department. I think that's what I'm going to do when I finish." And the chairman of medicine, for some reason, allowed him to design his own training program. Bruce is a tremendous guy. If you ever get a chance to meet him, you can ask him about the early days at the University of Cincinnati. But he's a very brave man, and he's a very bold man. He and his wife adopt impaired children. They have, I think, 2 kids of their own and about 14 others. And I just can't imagine how you do that. But he says, well, I've been very lucky in my life, and I think I should share the luck. And I guess that's what it takes to create a new specialty. He started in 1969, I believe, and in 1970, they started a residency at L.A. County in Los Angeles. And Gail Anderson had been the chairman of OBGYN there, and in what they thought was a way to get rid of him, they moved him to the emergency department. Now, the emergency department at L.A. County is a bit of a workload. They only see about 1,000 patients a day, and it's a difficult place to run, as you might imagine. But Gail was a survivor. He was one of the best masters of county hospital politics I ever met in my life, and he didn't go quietly from OBGYN. He said, well, of course, I'll be glad to run your emergency department. You just have to make it a department. And Gail was the first formal Department of Emergency Medicine and first chair of a Department of Emergency Medicine 20 years before it ever happened again. So he was, it was like my asking for tenure. He knew what to ask for. I was lucky. Anyway, Gail is another terrific guy who started a program that has been very successful in Los Angeles. And I see Jerry Whalen in the back of the room, who was the program director of that program for many years, and who I met when I was still at the University of Chicago, because I wanted him to come there as a resident, but he was smarter, and he went on out to L.A. County. I think you were one of the two that turned me down. But I don't hold it against you, Jerry. L.A. is much nicer than Chicago. Anyway, at the same time in 1972 that I started a resident, Dave Wagner started one on the intern level at MCP. Don Thomas started a class at Louisville, and R Squared Hanna started a class at Evanston Hospital in Chicago. So the concept of residency training had commenced. We didn't know what to train or how to train or where to train. The year that I started the resident, Bob Daly, who was the program director at L.A. County, got wind of the fact that we were all starting residencies and held a meeting in Los Angeles. And I remember sitting around trying to define what was an emergency and who was an emergency physician. And when you try to do it formally, it's much harder than just being one. So that was exciting times, and that was the fun of the creation of the new specialty. The problem was that after we started the residents, there was a Newtonian response to a force. And the response defied the laws of physics because it was greater than the initiating force. We had tremendous problems in Chicago with surgery and with medicine. In some ways, it defines the psychology of the specialties because the force from surgery was direct, was brutal, but was visible. The force from medicine was passive and was invisible, but probably over time was the greater antagonism. One of the surgical attendings nearly got into a fist fight with one of the emergency residents, and the chair of surgery came to me and said if I didn't fire that resident, he would have me sued for malpractice. So we trotted down to the chief of staff's office, and I said that we couldn't function in that kind of an environment, and that if they didn't like the way we practiced medicine, then they had an obligation to educate us, but that they weren't doing that. What they were doing instead was attacking us and attacking us unreasonably. And to my surprise, he backed down in front of the chief of staff, and he also backed down in attacking us at Surgical M&M. To make sure that continued, we assigned a faculty member to go to Surgical M&M's. Because Surgical M&M's are a little bit like feeding frenzies in sharks. And whoever bleeds first dies. So the job of the emergency faculty was to get the first bite and watch the other sharks swarm. The other thing that happened was, and I wish I'd done it sooner, the chairman of surgery had been my chair for a couple of years, and his wife still had me on the Christmas invitation list. She didn't know that I had transferred to the dean's office and was no longer in the Department of Surgery, so I got invited to the Christmas party, and I decided to attend. And it was well worth the cost of the bottle of scotch that I brought with me when I rang the doorbell, and the chairman of surgery opened the door, and his face when he saw me, I wish I had been able to record in a photograph. At any rate, he invited me in, and all the other surgical faculty said, "Oh, things must be okay now because he's here at the Christmas party." And as a result, we stopped having fights with surgery. So I would admonish you that when you're having trouble with another department, socialize with them. Take an internist out to lunch. You can stand it for an hour. We did not have admitting privileges in Chicago, although we hardly ever failed to get the patients admitted that we needed to, but it was a struggle. And I'll never forget one medical intern named Peter something. And Peter was always saying, "I can't admit this patient just because she's in congestive failure. I'm here to learn internal medicine. I'm not here to take care of simple congestive failure." So a number of months later, we had a woman present who was the daughter of a visiting professor from the Philippines. And she had black water fever, a very common disease in Chicago, as you might imagine. So we called Peter down and we said, "We found an admission for you, Peter, that's not mundane. This woman has falciparum malaria." And he says, and I quote, "I can't admit this just because she's interesting." And then I realized what you had to do, an admission to medicine. And I said, "No, you're right, Peter. I don't want you to admit this patient because she's interesting. I don't want you to admit this patient because she's an internal medicine problem. I want you to admit this patient because I want you to survive." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "If you don't admit her and every other patient I call you for the rest of your intern year, I'm going to kill you." So he found that argument persuasive. And we had less trouble with medical admissions. When I moved to Denver in 1977, that was one of my job demands, was that we had admitting privileges to every service. I also had a promise that I would be introduced onto the faculty at Denver General and made acceptable to the other departments. Well, the man I worked for was a man who worshipped Machiavelli. He had a copy of The Prince on his desk. Although I think he misunderstood Machiavelli, he believed in the principles enunciated in The Prince. So I was originally appointed as a member of the Department of Surgery at Denver General, and the chief of surgery, a guy named Ben Eisman, did not want emergency medicine there, and so he said he didn't want me in his department. And Dr. Sbarbaro Machiavelli said, "Well, tough, he's in your department." So Eisman resigned. And John said, "Hey, that worked pretty well." And he called me up and he said, "I'm not going to appoint you in surgery after all. I'm going to appoint you in medicine." The chairman of medicine resigned. So So without ever setting foot at Denver General, I was responsible for getting rid of two chief departments. It was a wonderful introduction to the University of Colorado. And as a result, I had no faculty appointment in Colorado for the first 8 years that I was in Denver. My faculty appointment was at the University of Oregon. And the reason for that was somewhat subtle. I had asked Oregon if they would give me a clinical faculty appointment because their residents rotated in Denver for a trauma experience. But the reason I wanted the faculty appointment was... Oh, shit. Sorry. Apologize. I had a retirement fund from the University of Chicago, and I didn't want to have to draw on it and pay taxes. So I got this adjunct faculty appointment at the University of Oregon, and we were going to hang a sign in front of Denver General University of Oregon East, but they decided to hold on that one. But that was the time when the LREC said that the residency had to have a university affiliation, and the people at the University of Colorado came to my boss and said, you have to fire him because there will be no university affiliation and you will lose your residency. And John said, well, but he's a professor at the University of Oregon. We have a university affiliation. So that did not help relations with the University of Colorado until 8 years later when Alden Harkin became chief of surgery at Colorado and came to see me at Denver General and said, we want more patients at the university. I said, well, there's not much we can do about that, Alden. The destination policy is what it is. He said, yeah, you know that, and I know that, but if you join the faculty, I think we'll get more patients. I said, I'm happy to join the faculty, but I don't think it will make any difference. And he said, and I said, besides, the problem at the university is not surgical patients, because we don't take trauma there, and there aren't that many surgical emergencies. I said, the problem is medicine, because we can't get patients admitted. And he said, well, just admit them to surgery. He said, there's no acute problem that a surgeon can't take care of, and there's no acute problem an internist can take care of. I said, well, that's a philosophy I agree with, but how do we admit a myocardial infarction to the surgical ICU? He said, you'll only have to do it once. And I said, you're probably right. So he gave me an appointment in the Department of Surgery, and we started rotating our residents to the university. And to my absolute surprise, we started bringing more patients to the university, because I really thought we were following destination policy, but I didn't realize how much the paramedics were following the policy as they chose to. And when they figured it was all right to go to the university, then they started taking patients there. Well, those are some of the memories of the early days in emergency medicine. And I think that when you're young, anything's possible. You don't know how difficult things are going to be. And to you, they're very simple, and they're very simple, and that everybody else won't see them that way. And that's good, because when you're young, you do impossible things because they're not impossible. But when you're older, then you start seeing the other guy's point of view, and that's always a mistake. My Uncle Harry was a guy who won every argument he was ever in. He was not a very good logician, and he wasn't very eloquent. He just never budged. And you would present him with all kinds of reasons why his argument failed, and he would just repeat his argument. And after a while, you'd get bored and you'd concede. And I realized that's a much better way of dealing with political arguments in academia than it is to try to be logical or produce evidence. Just be stubborn. And I think that Ed Levy, the president of the University of Chicago, put it very eloquently. He became attorney general. And when he was starting the job in Washington, they said to him, well, Mr. Levy, how are you going to cope with Washington politics? And he said, after 55 years at the University of Chicago, it'll be a snap. And he said, well, why is that, sir? And he says, well, academic politics are squalid because the stakes are so low. And I think that that's part of what you need to remember. The reality is there isn't much way to solve emergency medicine other than the way we've solved it. Other countries have tried a different approach. Canada, for example, has a specialty of emergency medicine that is practiced by non-specialties. Britain has consultants in emergency medicine who spend about 10 years training to be a consultant and then never see a patient again. And I don't know who delivers the daily care in those countries, but without an emergency physician, it's not delivered terribly well. And having watched this all over again in Tuscany the last few years, I can assure you that training makes a difference. It's one of those things that we really do believe that is almost unprovable, but which is real. For example, one of the things I did the first year I went over was to give a series of lectures before we gave the final exam. One of the lectures was on select medical emergencies, and one of the things I talked about was acute organic brain syndrome and why these patients need a lumbar puncture. The next day, one of the Italian physicians came to class and said, you know, I saw a patient last night just like you were lecturing about yesterday, and because of your lecture, I did an LP, and you know what? That patient had meningitis. And I thought about that for a while, and I said, that's a pretty good piece of evidence that the lecture and the training made a difference, but how could I prove it? The chances are, because it was an elderly patient with meningitis, the patient died. I don't know this because I don't know what happened to the patient after he got admitted, but the chances are greater that that's true than that the patient was salvaged by the LP. And I think that one of the problems we have faced as a specialty is to prove what is unprovable, but it is real. The analogy I often use is there isn't a scintilla of proof that training in neurosurgery makes a difference. But when you have your head cracked, do you want the guy who does it because he's interested in neurosurgery and started doing it after an internship in his garage? Or do you want someone who went to a neurosurgical training program? And if you look at your own careers, what you knew when you started in your residency, what you know today, and what you will know tomorrow, I think you will agree with me there's a vast difference. It isn't just the logic of the approach. It isn't just the trivial pursuit that you play as you learn the trivial facts that you need to know to be a good physician. It's the way you are willing to intervene for a patient. It is the way you think about patients, which is totally different from the way anyone else does. I remember reading an argument a couple of days ago from a woman who was very angry about her child's having received a diagnostic test for a fever. She said, I knew the child just had a viral infection, and the chances of the child having anything but that were so slim, I don't think the child needed that test. Well, that is logical and perhaps defensible, but that's not emergency medicine. Do we fail to do a fever workup because there's only a 1% chance of it being a bacterial infection? Of course not. And the reason is because we can't afford to miss that 1%. Patients fall into three groups. The first group is they're doctor proof, which is lucky. Doesn't matter what we do to them, they'll survive and they'll do fine. The second proof is doctor indifferent. That's a bad group to be in. No matter what we do, they're not going to do well, and they're going to fail. And the third group is the group for whom it makes a big difference what we do and if we do it in a timely fashion. Now, how do you tell which patient is in which group? The answer is you can't. And you certainly can't do it statistically, because statistically, most people probably fall into the group that are doctor independent. But how do you know that? So you'd better assume that every patient falls into the need the doctor group and behave accordingly. And I think that that's part of what we do as emergency physicians. you can't really prove that what you do makes a difference, but it does. And the reality is nobody else can prove what they do makes a difference, and there's no point, I think, in even trying. But nevertheless, it's a weapon that people have used to beat emergency medicine with for over 30 years. And they always use it because they have a different agenda. The agenda we have is really pretty simple. Patient has acute problem, doctor needs to fix acute problem. Doctor needs the help of the hospital to fix the acute problem. And then the walls of the other agendas kick in. And I think you just have to accept the fact that there is always going to be interface friction as your job as an emergency physician. But the way I look upon it is this. If you weren't smarter than they were, you would be in their field. You are smarter, and because you're smarter, you can outwit the bastards. Okay? There's nothing wrong with manipulating a consultant. There's nothing wrong with insulting him if that works. I was admitting a patient to an internist one night, and I was feeling pretty proud of myself for having made a diagnosis of adrenal insufficiency. And I get on the phone, and this is a Kaiser internist. Now, they're even lazier than internal medical residents, and it's very hard to convince them to admit patients. So I'm presenting the case to this guy, and he says, "Could you hurry up? I'm in the middle of dinner." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Could you put the doctor on the phone? I thought I was talking to the doctor." And it was a long silence on the other end of the line, and then he said, "Okay, tell me about the patient." So, you know, you are smarter than they are. You chose emergency medicine. You are a better doctor than they are because you're more interested in what happens to the patient than in protecting their work aversion. You can out-manipulate them, but you have to. Okay, it's not going to get any easier after you finish your residency. It's going to get harder. Doctors are going to be older. They're going to be more indifferent. They're going to want to protect their off time. It's going to be harder, not easier. But you will know better ways to do it because you'll have more experience. Don't give up on it. Okay, let's talk about the future a little bit. One of the things that is very hard to define is how practice of medicine is paid for. And we have struggled with that in this country for many, many decades, and we still don't have a good answer. There are those who feel that it should be the government, that we should have a single payer mix, and that would solve all of our problems. I can't say I'm a member of that group. Having worked in the Army, having watched the VA system, having looked carefully at the way the government manages Medicaid and Medicare, I don't want the government to have a monopoly on the payment of physicians. Secondly, there is something in our culture which we ought to recognize, and that is, what is it that incentivizes physicians? It's called money. And that sounds terrible, but it's not. That's a reality. Because that's what our society lives on. You may have the best ideals in the world, you may have the best motivations to help in the world, but if you don't have something with which to help, you can't do any good. It costs money to run an emergency department, it costs money to run a hospital. Where is that money to come from? I think you all need to think about that carefully as you move forward in your lives as physicians. Secondly, there's a lot of myth in medicine about what costs are. Costs are very, very difficult, if not impossible, to determine, and much of the literature that you read about medical costs is nonsense. If I don't order a CT scan, whatever the indications, does that X-ray tech go home? Does that X-ray tech get paid less? What have I saved in terms of real dollars, real cost? I saved the cost of the film. That's it, the supplies. We already paid a radiologist to be there. We already bought the equipment to take the CT scan. We already hired the X-ray tech. Those are the real costs. And how have I impacted them in any way? Secondly, if I do, in fact, save a lot of money not ordering that test, what's it used for? Does it buy immunizations for children that don't have them? Does it get put into research for a better way to care for ischemic coronary syndrome? No, it probably goes into the pocket of some administrator. So cost plus what's done with money is very hard to evaluate in medicine. But don't get it in your head that all of those dollars would then come to you as part of your salary. Whether you pay an administrative surcharge to a group, to a dean, to somebody, there are costs of running your group. And I think we need to remember that even as we struggle to have fairness and democracy in our group systems. What is a democratic group in emergency medicine? Is it a group that just makes every decision by majority vote? In fact, is that in fact democratic? And I think there are a lot of groups out there who are struggling with this question now, and it's democracy in action that we're not taught how to perform anywhere in our educational system. But it's something you need to think about. What is fair over time? Do you get any special privileges in your group because you're older, because you've been with the group for 10 years, because you've contributed to the longevity of that group over time? I think you need to address those questions and not just simply look at whether the salary is shared equally and whether the dollars are all shared equally. I probably have never worked for a democratic group, and I don't think I have had such a bad time in emergency medicine. Now, it's true that most of my emergency medicine, in fact, all of my emergency medicine career has been academic, but I can assure you academic groups are not democratic. I don't get to vote on what the chairman of my department does, the university does. And I think that there are other things that we work for that you have to look at. Money is an important incentivizer, but there are others. And there was a wonderful paper written many years ago in the Harvard Business Review called KITA, which is an acronym for kick in the ass. And it's a book about motivation. How do you motivate people? And the easiest answer, if you're the boss, is kick them in the ass when they don't perform. Well, that incentivizes you, but it doesn't incentivize the recipient of the kick. So how do you motivate people? Well, the author of this article says there's two ways. One is with hygienics. How many hours you work? How much do you get paid? What vacation do you have? What are your educational support? And the other is what he calls incentivizers, motivators. Title, the feeling of being important. What do you do because you do it? I like being a teacher because, as my friend Bob Daly put it, when you're a doctor, it's important, but when you take care of a patient, you're a multiple of one. But when you teach someone else how to do it well, you become a multiple of many. And I suspect that it's my own need for the kind of father-son and father-daughter relationships that I never had personally, but I've had with my own children, and that I've had with my residents. And I think that there are lots of motivators that make you choose what you do, and you have to figure out what your own are. And then you have to try to find an environment that permits that. That's difficult in a society that hasn't decided that it even wants to pay for health care, never mind pay adequately. There is no such thing as adequate support for indigent health care in this country. And it was, in fact, better many years ago when we had a two-class system where we had public hospitals for indigents and private hospitals for funded patients. The public hospitals weren't perfect, but they were good. Now the distinction is much less clear, and we've become very democratic. We treat everybody like shit. There was an article in the Boston Globe last year about how long it takes to get an appointment with a physician. All comers, not indigents, not wealthy people, just across the board. And around the country, it's 6 weeks. In Boston, it's 3 months. Boston having more physicians per capita than any other city in the country, but they're very smart. They don't take care of patients. So our system is flawed, and it needs to be fixed. Access to the system is very difficult, and it's getting harder. So when you try to choose a career in emergency medicine, you have to look at what's around you, not just what the emergency group is. One of the reasons that I spend part of my year in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, is because it's kind of like entering a time capsule and going back 50 years. There are private practices there that really function well. It's very easy to admit to medicine in Jackson because there are too many internists and they're hungry. And therefore, they don't fight with you when you want to put a patient on their service, or at least not as much as they do elsewhere. But I think you can look at other groups and discover that the emergency group is wonderful, but everything around it is not. And I submit that's not a good place to practice. So it's a difficult question, which is not going to get easier. I think that a lot of it can be identified with longevity in the group, who's in the group, who's senior in the group, how long it takes to get to be partner, whether they're residency graduates, and how do they stay current. But a lot of it is, what is the climate of your hospital? What is the payer mix of the population you serve? And what's it likely to be in the next 10 years? It's going to change on a national level. I'm not quite sure how, but I rather doubt that it's going to ever be a single payer. We know that there are more and more women going into medicine. I think that the last time I looked, the overall percentage was right at 50%, and with some schools at 52-53% female. There is not an equal distribution of leadership roles in medicine, and in emergency medicine in particular, it's been a peculiar gender discrimination that is by the choice of the women. In the 30 years that I've been training emergency physicians, we've never had more than 25% female applications. I don't know if that's because the field is harder for a woman to practice, or because there are so few women leaders in emergency medicine, or I don't know what the answer is. But that's a reality, and of course it's a self-perpetuating reality. The fewer women who apply, the fewer women leaders there are to choose from. And I think that that's something that will in fact change the practice of medicine, and has changed it in other specialties, and will probably someday change it in emergency medicine. Right now, for example, there is gender discrimination against males in OBGYN. As you finish an OB residency, you have a much harder time finding a job if you're a male OBGYN than if you're female. And I'm saying this neutrally. I don't mean that that's good or bad. It just is. I would say that right now it's harder for a woman to get a job in emergency medicine because people are worried about whether the woman will be available during pregnancy. And they're not rational when it comes to their own workload. So I think that's a reality that we have to figure out a solution to. How many emergency physicians do we need? I don't know. Nobody does. There are a lot of people who think they do, and about 4 years ago, there was a myth started that we had too many, and then for almost 2 years, we had a sharp decline in interest in emergency medicine on the medical student level. But the medical students have an uncanny wisdom about where the jobs are, and they've started applying again in ever greater numbers, so I'm very comfortable now that emergency medicine is going to survive. You know, 5 years ago, there were, I think, two students in the entire country who chose to go into anesthesia. The rest of the anesthesia slots went unmatched that year. Now people are going into anesthesia again. So the students know. I wish I knew how they knew, but they won't tell me. It's not information that can be processed by anyone over the age of 40. I think that there have been many myths about how long emergency physicians practice. And the reality is that they do retire earlier than other specialties. And I think the reality is they do because they can, not because they tire of emergency medicine. But in fact, there is a major difference in how long resident graduates practice emergency medicine than untrained emergency physicians. So I don't think that it's a career that you necessarily burn out for. I think it is a career that makes demands upon you physically that you don't anticipate when you're young. As you get older, night shifts don't get easier. As you develop some of the age change diseases like type 2 diabetes, you find it becomes physically very, very hard to perform well as an emergency physician. And maybe that's one of the reasons that more physicians retire at a younger age. But having said that, nobody really knows what the longevity is. You reach your economic goals earlier. You make top salary in emergency medicine probably 10 years sooner than in any other specialty. And it would seem to me that that being the case, you meet your retirement goals 10 years sooner. Academic growth has been wonderful, but not complete. And I'm not sure that that's a function of failure of the emergency academic physicians or whether it is a signal of change in academic medicine. Every field is finding it harder and harder to obtain government funds for research, and every field is finding it more and more essential to support itself on clinical dollars and finding it harder and harder to do that. So we're seeing academic faculty shrink, not expand, in every field, and I think that's a trend that will probably continue. Is the field attractive? Well, I think it still is. It is not attractive for the reasons that most people choose it. It's not an easy field. It, in fact, you will work more nights, weekends, holidays, and evenings than any other specialty. You spend more time at work working than any other field. There are more pressures upon you while you're working. There are all kinds of agendas that have to be filled, be it the nurse on duty who would think it a good shift if you went on bypass before she got there and came off after she left, to it the other specialties who don't want to be bothered at doing any of the thing that they went into medicine to do. But nevertheless, the field has gained respect. You no longer are treated with scorn because you say you're an emergency physician. Not that you ever were by patients, but your colleagues begin to understand that this is a real specialty and that it's one that they don't want to do, they don't know how to do, and therefore they're grateful that you do. I've been very gratified in Jackson Hole by many of the private physicians sending patients to the emergency department for me to consult on. This isn't because they're lazy, it's because they actually respect my opinion about their patient and I can help them. And I think that's happening more and more over time in more and more places. So it's not a bad career from that point of view. It's still a safety net for the system. No matter how the health planners have plotted to close emergency departments and bemoan the fact that not everybody in the emergency department has a life-critical illness, that's still the only way to get into the medical delivery system. For anybody. When I had an episode of heart failure 2 years ago, I could not find a cardiologist who would see me post-hospital because the attending who cared for me in the hospital only works in the hospital. And everyone else was full. Now, if I can't subvert the fucking system in my own hospital, who can? What happens to the poor stump who comes in off the street? It's impossible. The system has to change. And until it changes, the ED is going to be there as the safety net. The plaintiff bar. Malpractice is a problem. It's a problem in how we practice, it's a problem for why we practice, and it's a problem in our society that is probably going to get worse before it gets better. Because it's driven by nothing that has anything to do with medicine. When you are sued, it's not because the medical care was bad. you are sued because somebody has an economic opportunity. And that doesn't mean that all care is good. It doesn't mean that everybody is doing a great job for their patients. But it means that there's a difference between practicing medicine and practicing law. And unfortunately, our legislation and our society is driven by lawyers, not by physicians. People don't like doctors. In large measure, it's because the doctors haven't earned their trust. In large measure, it's because doctors are more interested in their own needs than they are in the patients. Patient doesn't care who you are, or where you went to school, or whether you trained. The patient wants to be taken care of and assumes that you know how to do that. So don't expect them to reward you because you went to Yale. The patient could give a flying fuck if you ever went to medical school. In the 46 years I've been a doctor, no one has ever asked me if I went to medical school or where. In fact, I was seeing a patient one day who had an acute torticollis, and I manipulated her neck, and one of the nurses walking by said, "I didn't know you were a chiropractor," and the patient said, "Oh, are you a chiropractor?" And I said, no, but I know a few of the techniques. So the patient smiled gratefully and did quite well and came back a week later and asked for the chiropractor. All I can say is that patients don't owe you, you owe them. And the more your ego gets into it, the less patients will like you. And I think that we need to take a look at that as we interact with patients. You don't have to have a patient for 30 years to inspire trust in the patient. All you need is what Lewis Thomas called the gift of affection. You have to make people understand that you care. You have to love them. My God, how can you love someone who smells like that and has bed bugs? But they're people. You have the duty, the responsibility, and the opportunity to take care of them. And if you do it, they'll trust you, and in fact, they won't sue you. That, to me, is the thing that has to change as much as tort reform. You won't get sued if you have good outcomes. And you'll have good outcomes if you make it safe for the patient, which means get your fucking ego out of the equation. Don't take shortcuts. Oh, I've been a doctor for 35 years, and I can look at a patient and know when they have a viral illness. Bullshit. Nobody can. So do the fever workup. And don't take shortcuts. Ask yourself one question about every patient every time. Is it safe? That's what I call the Marathon Man question. You all saw that movie? Is it safe? If it's not safe, do something different. If it is safe, you won't be sued. And I think that, in fairness, without the plaintiff bar, there would be no specialty of emergency medicine. That's what drove it in this country. And I think that there are bad lawyers, there are bad cases, but there are, contrarily, also bad physicians and bad medical practice. You don't be guilty of it. Okay, William James once said there are three stages to a theory. And in emergency medicine, we've lived through the first stage. I think we're mostly through the second stage. And last week, some OB told me that his field had started emergency medicine, so I believe we're in the third stage. Why be an emergency physician? I became a doctor because I wanted to do a lot of these things. I wanted to know what to do when someone had an acute problem. I wanted to be able to prevent death, at least some of the time. I wanted to help people who needed help, and I didn't care who they were. And I wanted to feel like I was making a difference in my community. I've been an emergency physician now for 36 years, and I feel that. I haven't wasted my life. There were many other things I could have done with my life. Maybe some of them would have been more useful, maybe some of them would have been more amusing. But I doubt it. And I'm old enough now that there's more behind me than in front of me, but it gives me great pride to look at what's behind me and say, that was emergency medicine. I got a chance to do something that made a difference. And so do you. I wish you well.